We're entering the book of Bamidbar. Last Shabbos we concluded the book of Vayikra, and this week we begin the book of Bamidbar. Classically, the book of Bamidbar is a book that's far less interesting than the other books. If you thought Vayikra was hard, because Vayikra had all the korbanos, well, Bamidbar is called Chumash HaPkudim, the book of counting. And in Bamidbar, you have a lot of numbers. The Jewish people are counted in our parsha, and then the Levites are counted, and then in Noso they're counted, and at the end of Noso, you have a recurring 12 series of about 10 psukim each of the sacrifices of each of the Nesiim. And the feeling throughout the book of Bamidbar is that there's a lot of repetitiveness, and it's a tiring book. There's another point about the book of Bamidbar, and that is that the book of Bamidbar is the book of the summer, which means that most people don't know the book of Bamidbar. Even people who went to a Jewish day school figure we're approaching the month of June. So that means that most kids aren't in school for these parshios. And so there's a gaping hole in most people's knowledge of the Torah when it comes to the book of Bamidbar. The book of Bamidbar has a lot of important information. It is divided really into three books. There are the upside down nuns, as we will see in Parshas Noso, that divide the book of Bamidbar into the first section that runs up until those two psukim. The psukim are Vayhi bin So Aaron Vayomer Moshe. But right there you have an upside down before those psukim and an upside down nun after those psukim. And the book of Bamidbar really is divided into three books. And we really say there are seven books of the Torah, because Bamidbar counts as three. You have one book that's just those two verses in the middle. That's our tradition. The book of Bamidbar really is also a slightly difficult book in that it has a lot of depressing stories. You have the sin of the Meraglim, the sin of Korach, the sin of Miriam and Aaron speaking badly about Moshe. Miriam's passing, Aaron's passing. It's a difficult book. You get to the end of the book, and you have a recounting of the travels of the Jews. So again, the whole book seems like it's recounting. It's like an accountant's book, the book of Bamidbar. Accountants like Bamidbar. It's all counts, a lot of numbers. They travel here, they travel there, they travel here, travel there. But the truth is that the book of Bamidbar is no less important than any other book in the Torah. There's tremendous depth. There are tremendous halachos that are learned from it. It's true that there are very, very few mitzvos that are introduced in the book of Bamidbar, but you do have Parshas Pinchas, for example, which teaches you all the korbanos of all the Yomim Tovim. You do have Parshas Matos, which teaches you the laws of vows. You do have Parshas Naso, where you have the laws of a Nazir, you have the laws of a Sota. So there are many things that we will encounter in the book of Bamidbar. And being that we're starting a new book, I want to take a few minutes to introduce some things that we should take into account. Number one, take advantage of the time here in Yeshiva to get into good habits with regard to the Parsha. A Jew that's connected to the Parsha is a Jew that's connected. And you should take the time every day to learn a little bit of that Aliyah. If you do that, you stay connected. We had a student here a number of years ago who learned here for a month or two, and then came time to leave. It came to my attention at the time that at home they didn't eat kosher, they didn't keep Shabbos, there was nothing observant about the home at all. And we met before he left, and I asked him, tell me, is there anything you're taking away from the Machon? Is there anything you got over here? So he said, the Machon's a very nice place, I enjoyed my time here. I said, is there anything you're taking back with you? So he thought for a minute. He said, yeah, there are nice people here. So I said, is there any one mitzvah you feel you connect to? So he said, well, when I'm at the Machon, it's nice to daven, and it's nice to make Kiddush. I said, is there anything you'll take back with you? So he thought for a minute. He said, let's see. Shabbos? No. Kashrus? No. Marrying Jewish? No. I can't think of anything. This was the conversation. So I appreciated his honesty. I mean, we're still good friends. I said, I don't want to leave on that note. Think of one thing that you could take back with you. Yeah, you spent 2 months here. I'm sure you got something. I thought the angle that he really got was prayer. So I suggested that. He surprised me, and he came back and said, although I don't see myself observing any of the mitzvot I learned at the Machon, but I will take back one thing, and that is that every night I will review that aliyah of the parsha. So that's an interesting thing. He's telling me he's not going to keep any of it, but he still wants to learn it. Fine. I was skeptical. A half a year later, I get an email, Rabbi, it's amazing, every night before I go to sleep, I do the aliyah. It's so inspiring. I see on Facebook that his girlfriend is really not Jewish. We're still friends. A year later, he comes to visit me. It's so inspiring. Every night, I learn that aliyah. It's an amazing thing. I see on Facebook that even as he's in Israel, he's partying on Shabbos. Shabbos is non-existent. A year later, I get an email. He says, I'm coming to Israel to Eisha Torah. So I write him back, good luck. A person who can stay connected to the parsha is staying connected. And it's a tremendous asset if you guys can do that. I sometimes speak to guys before they enter the army, and the guys tell me, I have 3 minutes I could learn when I'm in the army. What can I do during those 3 minutes? I say parsha. If you can get in one halacha, good, and the parsha. The parsha is what's important. It'll keep you with things. When you come to shul on Shabbos, you'll have a clue what's going on. When you'll sit at a Shabbos table, you'll be able to say something from the parsha. Parsha, guys. Parsha is critical. And especially in light of all the introductions I gave about how difficult the book of Bamidbar is, because it's really like an accounting. It's really not too much fun. But it's time to get into the habit. That's it. You guys are grown men. You're going to have families. You're going to have to come to the Shabbos table and give Divrei Torah. You have to know what the parsha is about. And so you have to get into the habit of learning the parsha. And I want to tell you another thing, which I want you each to think about. Anyone that made it to Machon Meir is unique. No one got here on easy street. Everyone had to contend with challenges to get here. Which means that although you're learning new information, and you might not be the person who knows the most about the Torah, but each of you has a strength in that you have leadership qualities. You were able to go against the grain and come here and stick it out and learn here. I have a good friend who left yeshiva, went to college. He's in college, and a group of guys come to him, 2-3 guys. They tell him, we sit down for lunch together anyways. We don't go to shul on Shabbos. We don't keep Shabbos. But we'd like to know what the parasha is about. Do you mind telling us a few minutes just about the parasha every day during lunch? So the guy says, fine. To make a long story short, today he gives a class. He has over 150 students during lunch who come and sit and eat their lunch while he gives them 5 minutes on the parsha. Over 150 guys, some keep Torah, some don't keep Torah, they all want to know what the parsha is about. So every day he gives a 5 minute class on just what's that aliyah or something on the parsha. He sums up the parsha for them. He'll ask me, is this guy the chief rabbi of Israel? No. Does he get to learn during the week? Very little. Is he a huge Talmud Chacham? No. But he took what he does know and he was able to give it to others. You guys each have the capacity to do that. If you came here, that means you have the qualities to stand up and do things and accomplish things. And then you should not only learn the parsha for yourself, you should find opportunities to teach others. And if you teach others, you'll end up knowing it better, you'll end up connecting to it better. So that's an introduction which I want you all to have. Now's the time to get into the habit. Even though the book of Bamidbar is a difficult book to start with, it's the time to get into the habit, and once you get into the habit, it gets easier every day to do that aliyah. You missed an aliyah, you had a wedding, whatever it was, so tomorrow you make up for it. On Shabbos, during the laning, you'll review it again. You'll be more connected to what's happening in shul. When we enter the book of Bamidbar, so the anticipation by the Jewish people is that we're headed into Israel, that's it. The book of Vayikra even closes with finishing remarks. These are the mitzvot. It's as though everything else was left to the oral law. And that's the plan. That's where things should have headed. We count the Jewish people in anticipation of the wars we will encounter. We set up the Jewish camp in anticipation of the journey into the land of Israel. We prepare the camp with its holiness, with its different boundaries, and the responsibilities of the Levites in traveling towards the land of Israel. And that's our parsha, the different responsibilities. After we count each tribe, we have the responsibilities of the different families of the Levites. Each one carries different things. The Torah describes to us the flags and the way in which we travel. We run into an issue because the Levites are supposed to be in place of the firstborn, and there's a discrepancy. We have how much was the number? Yeah, the extra.
22,300, and the answer
is
20,000. And
there
was
273
there redeemed.
273, okay. So 273 firstborn that don't have Levim to take their place. So they have to give 5 silver coins to redeem themselves from their holiness of being firstborn. And then at the end of the parsha we start count what?
Like
Pidyon HaBen, correct. And then at the end of the parsha we have the responsibility of the Levite family. So that's an overview of our parsha. While we're at it, we'll do a quick overview of the whole book of Bamidbar. In Naso, we continue the count. We have the commandment in Naso about the responsibilities that a person has if he takes a vow, a false vow, the sacrifice that he brings, the whole laws of Sota. If a woman acts immodestly and her husband suspects that she's cheating on him, he could do the whole procession with the Sota waters to verify if she's committed adultery or not. Then we have the mitzvah of Nazir, that a person can take a vow that he will not drink wine, he can become a Nazir, and then he doesn't get defiled, and he doesn't cut his hair, and the sacrifices to end that. Then we have the mitzvah of Birchas Kohanim, the blessing the Kohanim give the Jewish people. And we conclude Parshas Naso with the sacrifices that were brought by the leaders to inaugurate the tabernacle, to inaugurate the Mishkan. The Halosha begins with the commandment of the lighting of the menorah and the inauguration of the Levites, the whole procession of the sacrifices and the procession that was done to imbue the Levites with their holiness. Parshas Halosha continues, and it takes us back in time. In Shlishim Parashas Baaloscha, we rewind. Ein mukdam u'mocher b'Torah. The Torah is not written in chronological order, but in an order to pass on certain information. Meaning, the Torah purposely put things in specific places. Now, the Torah does not adhere to chronological order. And so we rewind, and we go back to the Paschal offering that was brought when we were out in the desert, the first year we were in the desert. And then there were people who were defiled. They couldn't bring that Paschal offering. So they come and they say, we don't want to miss out. And we have the mitzvah of Pesach Sheni, the capacity, if you miss the first Pesach, to make up for it a month later. The Torah tells us about how the cloud settled on the Mishkan and how the Jewish people would travel in accordance with how the cloud moved. God commands Moshe to make himself trumpets, like a king has trumpets, and God commands how we blow the trumpets to gather the people to go out to war, and the mitzvah of praying when there is a time of danger and we go out to war. we start traveling. We're headed towards Israel. Moshe tells his father-in-law, come with us. We're headed to Israel. It'll be good for you. And Yisrael says, no, I got to go bring my family. I got to go convert them. We have the parsha of Vayhi b'nsa'a machane, Vayhi b'nsa'a aron, Vayomer Moshe, and the nation complains. We're about to enter the land of Israel. They start complaining. A fire comes out and kills people. And Moshe prays and the fire gets buried. The people start complaining. We want meat. We want fish. This man is terrible. You're about to enter the land of Israel. And they mess up again. God sends them the slav. The people start complaining about all the mitzvos of family. They can't marry any woman they would like. Here the Torah is constricting their capacity to go with women. People aren't happy about it. Moshe says to God, how could I handle all this? And God tells Moshe, we're going to appoint 70 elders to be with you. God gives them the slav, that special bird, and people go and gorge out on the slav, and many, many people drop dead. When we appoint the 70 elders, so two people start prophesizing inside the camp, and they talk about how Moshe is going to die and Yehuda is going to lead the people into the land of Israel. Yoshua says, put them in jail. How could they talk that way? Moshe says, don't worry about it. It's great. Everyone should be prophets like them. And at the end of the parasha, we have the story of Miriam and Aaron speaking Lashon Hara about Moshe. Miriam and Aaron get Tzaras. And, okay, I didn't know. And Miriam ends up 7 days outside the camp. And then we enter the terrible parasha of Shlach. It's a beautiful parasha of Shlach. It's got terrible things. The Jewish people sin their 10th sin when the spies come back. And the Jewish people say they don't want to enter the land of Israel on Tisha B'Av night. They weep the whole night saying they don't want to go into the land of Israel. And God punishes the spies. They die a terrible death as their tongue protrudes into their belly button and worms start crawling through their intestines and out their tongue. And there's a plague and the people are told they are not going to enter the land of Israel. That's it. You didn't want to go. You're not going to go. 40 years in the desert. For every day that the spies traveled Israel, there was a year taxed upon us to travel the desert. And at the end of the parasha, we have the story of the mitzvah of tzitzis, at the end of Shlach. Right after the parasha of Shlach, we run into the parasha of Korach. The people have to live with the fact that they're not going to enter the land of Israel. So there's a great mutiny against Moshe with Korach leading the way, with many elders and Dothan and Aviram claiming that Moshe is only in it for the power, for the pride. And we know the story. The ground opens up and swallows them. The people complain again, and a heavenly fire comes out and kills many of the people. And then God says, okay, we'll show them. Put a staff from each tribe inside the holy, and put Aaron's staff, and Aaron's staff is the one that produces fruit, so everyone knows that he's the chosen one. And the Torah records over here what are the rights of the Kohanim. What gifts do the Kohanim get, and what gifts do the Levites get? That's an end of the Parshas Korach. Parshas Chukas gives us the mitzvah of Parah Aduma, the laws of defilement for a dead body, the laws of how to purify from that with the red heifer. Then we hear about Miriam's passing. The nation loses their water, which came in the merit of Miriam. And then Moshe and Aaron's famous sin in hitting the rock. And it is decreed that they will not enter the land of Israel. We go and we ask Edom to pass through their territory to go into Israel, and Edom refuses. We travel all the way around Edom, and it's time for Aaron to pass. Aaron goes up into the mountain and passes his clothing to his son. Aaron passes away. The nation weeps his passing for 30 days, and we're attacked. When we're attacked by the Kanani, we take a vow that if we get there, if we conquer them, we will give whatever we conquer, we will dedicate it to God. And we succeed. We succeed in that war. We start traveling, and it's a long journey, and people start complaining about God and Moshe and the whole journey, and snakes start biting the people, and people are dropping like flies. They come to Moshe, and they beg forgiveness for speaking badly about him and God, and God tells Moshe to make a copper snake, put it on a post, and whoever's bitten can look up to that copper snake and be healed. We continue traveling, and we have great stories in these travelings where nations tried to ambush us, and God crushed them without our even knowing it, and we sang songs in honor of that afterwards when we saw it happen. And finally, we are attacked by the great kings of Sihon and Og, and we destroy them and conquer their land on the eastern side of the Jordan. And that's the conclusion of Parshas Chukas. Parshas Balak brings us to the Moabites getting all nervous after we've conquered their neighbors, Sihon and Og. They hire Balak to come curse us, and we know Balak and the mule talks back to Balak, and finally, Balak is unsuccessful in cursing us. He has to leave after having blessed us three times, but he gives advice. He says, you want the nation to fall, seduce them. Send out the girls to seduce them. Set up tents out there and send out your girls to seduce them. And that's what happens. And 24,000 people die as Jews are seduced by the Moabite and Midianite women. And the one to stand up to all of this is Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the Kohen. He goes up and he kills the leader, the top girl, the top guy who was leading all of this, and the plague stops after 24,000 Jews died. Everyone starts talking about Pinchas. Who do you think you are? Standing up and killing a leader. And God steps into the picture and says, he's my man. He's the one that saved you people. Thanks to him, people didn't continue dying. And God commands us to hold it against the Midianites for what they did. They sent their top daughters, their princesses, just to cause us to sin. Again, we have a commandment to count the Jewish people. And again, in Parshas Pinchas, there is the count of the different tribes and the different families, and this count is preparatory to entering the land of Israel. The count in Parshas Pinchas. At the end of Parshas Pinchas, we have the daughters of Tzlofchad, who claim that being that there are no sons, they should get an inheritance, and God backs them. The girls do get an inheritance. And Moshe is told, you come up the mountain, see the land of Israel, because you're going to pass away. You wanted to see the land of Israel, you could see it, but you're going to die. And Moshe asks for a new leader to be appointed, and God says, fine, Yoshua is going to be the next leader. You anoint him in front of everyone. And then we have the conclusion of Parshas Pinchas, which are the sacrifices that are brought daily and the sacrifices of each holiday. That brings us to the concluding parshios of the book of Bamidbar, Matos and Maaseh, where we have the laws of vows in Parshas Matos, and we have the war against the Midianites, and we have the laws of Tevilas Kelim and Kashering Kelim, and we have the enumeration again of all the loot that was conquered, and we have Reuven and Gad asking that they should inherit the eastern side of the Jordan, and Moshe's deal with them that they have to go and fight the war, and then they could inherit the eastern side of the Jordan. Parshas Maaseh is the concluding parsha of Bamidbar. It records the traveling, the journeys of the Jewish people, and the commandment that we wipe out any form of paganism in the land of Israel when we enter the land of Israel, that we draw lots in order to divide the land of Israel, and then the description of the boundaries of the land of Israel are at the conclusion of Parshas Maaseh. Where does Israel lie? What are the boundaries? We conclude Parshas Maaseh with the commandment of setting up Levite cities, and the commandment of setting up cities of refuge. If a person kills by mistake, he should be able to run away to the cities of refuge. And at the end, we have the Shidduch, the families of Pnos Tzlovchad. They come and they complain. They say, if these girls marry out of the tribe, so then that part of our land, our territory, will go to other tribes, because the husband's children, I mean their children, will be from another tribe. And God says, fine, let them marry within the tribe. And they do. So the book of Bamidbar ends with Shidduchim. And that brings us back to the beginning of Bamidbar. Now that we did a whole overview of the book of Bamidbar, let's begin. Okay. We're in the desert. And that's where we're going to discuss the Torah. Bamidbar, the Torah was given in a desert. And the Torah is compared to fire, as Sinai was all encompassed with fire when the Torah was given, and water, as it says that the mountains, the clouds dripped with water as God gave the Torah. Why is the Torah equated with these three? Fire, water, and the desert. Because these are three things that people recognize are free. You can go to a stream and get yourself water. You can ask people, they'll give you a glass of water. You can ask people for a flame, they'll give you fire, and anyone could go and travel in the desert. And God wanted us to realize that just as fire, water, and the desert each have their element of freedom, so too the Torah is supposed to be free. God gave the Torah as something that's accessible to everyone. And we have a commandment that you're not supposed to charge money for teaching Torah. You want to learn Torah, it should be readily available. And every person should know that it's accessible to him. And I would add to this medrash that we also have to know that the Torah is always waiting for us. A person will sometimes say, I haven't learned Torah for 30 years, I'm going to start now? And the answer is yes. One of the great things we see today in Jerusalem is that all over Jerusalem, there are kolels sprouting up. You could go to the Great Synagogue and you'll see every day hundreds of senior citizens gathering at the Yeshurun Synagogue, right next to the Great Synagogue, and learning and listening to classes, hundreds. And all over Jerusalem, you have seniors who decided, I can start learning now. You go up to the library up here on any morning, you'll see quite a bunch of seniors who decided that they're going to learn Torah now. Torah is a fantastic thing. We can learn it at any point in our lives, and we could always see new insights, and it can always talk to you. And if the Torah is not talking to you, then you're not accessing it correctly. The Torah can talk to a person at every stage in his life, and it's up to the person if he wants to listen and if he wants to find it. If you're going to try to find Torah by doing things in Torah that don't speak to you, then the Torah might not talk to you. I was once dating a girl who felt very badly that her father didn't learn Torah. So she said to me, how do you view people who don't learn Torah? So I said, it's not my job to judge other people. So she said, okay, fine, not how do you view people who don't learn Torah, but do you think that every person should learn Torah? So I said, definitely. So she said, but what about people who can't learn Gemara? So I said, there's a lot to Torah other than Gemara. There's Chumash, there's Navi, there's Medrash, there are stories. You don't only learn Talmud. A person can't say, I'm not cut out for Talmud, I don't know enough to learn Talmud, I can't learn. There's Mishnah, there's Halacha. Every person can and should learn Torah, and it's no excuse. And with time, as a person grows, hopefully he'll also learn to access Talmud, because that is the top level. That is where Halacha comes from, and that is the unifying piece of information that connects and explains the Medrash and the Chumash and the Halacha. Talmud is that, but you don't have to learn only that. Dov, you seem perplexed. Midrash is the Agadic works. We have Agadic works on the Torah, and they're called Midrash. Midrash literally means derivation, but it is what our sages derived on the verses. Some Midrashim are Midrashei Halacha, where they, what?
Where would you find it?
They're separate works. And you have Midrashim that focus on going verse by verse and showing you the halachos that were derived from the verse, the same way Moshe would teach the verses. Moshe would say a verse and say, okay, now from this verse we derive, and he'd give you the halachic derivations verse by verse. And then you have Midrashei Agadah, Midrashim that focus on telling you stories and themes, agadic thoughts on each verse. So that's like the Medrash Rabbah, Medrash Tanhuma. Those are names of Midrashim that are more agadic. A person can take in English, Medrash says, and learn it. So, Bamidbar, when the Torah stresses that the Jewish people are in the desert, the Torah is telling you, just like the desert was free for all and still is free for all, so too with Torah. The Jewish people are going to be counted. And the Torah stresses that they're counted based on their families. Chazal tell us that the nations have a complaint. The nations said, why do you choose them? Why are they any different than us? Are they perfect? They're not perfect. So we're not perfect either. What's unique about the Jewish people? And you know what God's answer is? God doesn't say because they keep Shabbos. Not everyone keeps Shabbos. God doesn't say because they keep Kashrus. Not everyone keeps Kashrus. These are very important mitzvos, but that's not God's answer. God says because they're faithful to their families. Because they know that their son is their son. That's not to say there aren't Jews who don't commit adultery. Unfortunately, we know that that happens too. But it's a rarity. In general, we do stick to our families, and we've always stuck to our families. And that is our claim to fame. When God gives us the count in this week's parasha, God is also stressing they have families. They could show where they come from. And that is a strength. The fact that today the family structure is being ruptured is a calamity. And we suffer from it more than anyone else. And that's why one of the first things that a person has to work on is fixing their traits and laying the foundation to build a good home. We say this often, that the home you build is, to my mind, the greatest measure of your success in learning here. Every person should continue learning Torah and keeping mitzvos, but the home is the reflection of the Torah. When the Jewish people sinned at the end of the book of Bamidbar, that they went with the women in the Moabite women, so the nation started saying, you see, they're just like us. We're not perfect. And when people were seduced, and people, 24,000 people, went with the Moabite women, so the nations came back and said, so what's so special about them Jews? So God right away made a plague and 24,000 people dropped dead. It's a huge number, 24,000 people.
Including the Moabites?
No. 24,000 Jews.
But did these girls die as well?
Not that I know of, no. I think it's pretty clear in the Talmud that not.
Just the Jews
died.
I thought in the end, though, that if I'm not mixing stories up,
Later. At war they died. They died at war, but they didn't die in the plague. God didn't kill them. We killed them at war. There was a king who married a woman. And he didn't bother writing a marriage contract. And when the relationship was over, he didn't bother writing a divorce contract. Married a second wife, same thing, and a third wife, the same thing. So now he's single again. He's on the market, and he sees a young girl, an orphan. She's poor, but she comes from a good family. And he takes a liking to her. So he tells his buddy, he says, I want to marry her, and I'm not going to treat her like I treated her predecessors. She comes from a good family. She is modest in her ways. She's a kosher girl. I will write a marriage contract with her. I want to write down what day, what year. We're going to have a real marriage ceremony, and we're going to get married. That's the way the world, the way God dealt with the world. God created the world, and there were great leaders in the world. And there were great people in the world. And then there was a flood and a great calamity. Most of the world was killed. And then God had, again, a great king in the world and great technological advancements in the world. And then Dor HaPalaga, God went down and banished them throughout the land. Again, the world was developing and evolving, and you had Mesopotamia, you had Sodom and Amorah, you had areas that were lush, and you had a kingdom that was extraordinarily successful financially, and they were a powerful kingdom, they could take down giants, and God overturns them. And then you have another economy with great leaders and great priests who could master astronomy and tell you when the Nile would rise, and they make great advancements in mathematics and developing a calendar, and they're a great civilization, but God destroys them. So we have great civilizations in the world history prior to the Exodus from Egypt. And one by one, these civilizations come and go, and the Torah records their greatness, their coming, their growing, their golden era, and their destruction without a date. Comes our parsha, and suddenly there's a date. God says, I am treating them differently than their predecessors. This is a civilization that's going to last. They're not wealthy like the Egyptians. They don't have a lush territory like the Sodomites. They're not powerful like the Dor of the Mabul or the Dor HaPalaga. But they're good people. And they come from a good family, from Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And so Hashem says, now let's record the location. Let's record the time. Let's record the date. They're mine. We're making a marriage contract, and this is forever. That's what marriage represents, a commitment to forever. And that's what the Torah stresses by us. It says it was the first day of the second month and the second year that we left Egypt. And God says, now count them, because every Jew is important. I want to count. The Torah says when we count the Jewish people, you count them based on their father's house. The family is based on the father's. And this is where we derive the concept that the family goes based on the father. You want to know what tribe you're from? It goes based on your father. It's unique that Judaism goes by the mother. But technically, your family is defined by your father. When the Torah says, get the leaders, so the Torah says, Kiru'ei Eida. And the word is written, Kiri'ei Eida. So we have a tradition that they were modest people. They were the top astronomers, they were the top wise men, and they were chosen by the people, but they treated their position with humility. So the Torah calls them Kru'ei Eida, chosen by the people. But they refer to themselves as Kru'ei Eida, the coincidence, those people who happen to be in the leadership position. They were humble, so the Torah gives them the honor. By Korach, it's the exact opposite. Korach and his clan, they decided they want to be the leaders, they're going to take the throne. So they define themselves as the leader. The Torah purposely calls them Kri'ei Eida, the coincidences, the people who happen to step forward and think that they're going to lead the people. When we have the enumeration of the tribes, so the tribe of God comes first. Why is God first? What's unique about God? So the Targum tells us in the end of the Torah that because God had the merit that Moshe was buried in their section. Moshe was buried in their section and their territory. So that's why they were honored that they, in the enumeration, they come first. What about the tribe of Naphtali? Why are they always last? So the Talmud tells us, the Medrash tells us that from the names of the children, we can see their nature. We can see that sometimes they went after their desires. Sometimes they would speak badly about their fellow man. Sometimes they would pay back unfairly. A guy would treat him nicely and he'd treat him back harshly. He'd treat him back badly. So because of that, because their traits weren't up to par with the other tribes, whenever it comes to counting the tribes, Naphtali is last. The Torah wants to deride them, to put them down. And here again, we see how much the Torah values how we treat one another. Yeah?
Isn't it a bit generalizing? Like,
yes, it is.
Huge
right. So the question is, like every time we say something like this, was it something that was prevalent in the tribe? Or was it something that existed and the tribe didn't take care of it and that's why the tribe is held accountable for it? So it could be there were only two families or five families who were like this, but people knew about it and they didn't deal with it. So when people can rectify something and choose to ignore it, the Torah will very often treat it as though they're that way too. The Talmud says an even greater line. The Talmud says if someone is slandered that he's done something and really he didn't do it, then one great possible cause is that he saw others do it and could have stopped them and didn't. So the way God pays him back is sometimes God will have the person slandered for that same thing. The tribe of Levi is chosen. The Levites are chosen. When Moshe stands after the golden calf, he stands at the entrance to the camp and he says, Mila Shem Elai. Whoever feels his part is with God, come to me. He expected that the firstborns would gather. All the Bechoros, all the firstborns would come. They're God's chosen ones, right? They didn't. Who came? The Levim came. Levi came. So we have a rule. Whoever advances a little towards God, then God grabs him and pulls him even more. When Moshe said, Mi Lashem Elai, the tribe of Levi stepped forward. So God says, you step forward, I'm going to push you all the way up. And so the tribe of Levi in our parsha gets that great role of being the guards at the temple, being the teachers of Israel. There's a story which I want you guys to take home with you. But before I tell you the story, I'll tell you another story. In the afternoons, I learned with guys in a Hesder yeshiva called Torah Betzion. And the Rosh Yeshiva there is a man by the name of Rav Nachum Neria and his son Rav Yitzchak Neria. So we once had a group of guys come from Bnei Akiva, and the guys were not Shabbos observant, they weren't Kashrus observant. There was very little that spoke to them in Judaism. And they were all headed back to Europe to their colleges. And they just had a fling, you know. They came to Israel, so they came to yeshiva for a short period. And it was Hanukkah. And we had a party, a going away party for them. So they asked each of us to speak. And you ask yourself, what can you say to a group that's leaving you to such an environment? An environment which is antithetical to Judaism. And they didn't really connect too much in the short time they were by us. So I marveled at the brilliance of Rav Yitzchak Neria. When he spoke, he said the following. He said, Hanukkah is a celebration of select individuals who stood up to the calling when the odds seemed against them. They weren't willing to bow their heads as Jews. They stood up and said, we're going to fight. They didn't know if they'd be successful or not. He said, every one of you, every individual in his life is going to have a time when his Judaism is challenged. And he has to decide, is he going to be brave enough to stand up like the Hashmonaim and declare, I'm a Jew and this is what I stand for. And that was his speech in a nutshell. So that's story number one. I thought that was brilliant. Story number two goes with the Chafetz Chaim. That person... I don't remember the details of the story. This was a story before World War II. A person came to the Chafetz Chaim, and he was going to be in a very influential role, this person. And before he left, the Chafetz Chaim asked him, "Are you a Kohen?" So the guy said, "No, I'm not." So the Chafetz Chaim said, "Well, I am." So the guy standing wondering, what does Chafetz Chaim want from him? So the Chafetz Chaim said, "Why aren't you a Kohen?" So the man says, "Because my father's not a Kohen." He's trying to think, what's Chafetz Chaim getting at? So the Chafetz Chaim says, "And why am I a Kohen?" So he says, "Because your father was a Kohen." So the Chafetz Chaim says, you want to know why I'm a Kohen? You want to know why we're different? Because there was once a time in Jewish history when there was a calling of Mi Lashem Eli. Who stands up for Hashem? And my tribe stood up and said, we're going to stand up for it. And every person has their times in their life when there's a calling. Who's going to stand up for Hashem's name? Who's going to stand up for what's right? Don't miss your opportunity. You missed it once. Your great, great, great grandfather, until today, you're not a Kohen or a Levi. Because your tribe did not stand up when the calling came out, Mi Lashem Eli. So if your great, great, great grandfather missed it, don't repeat the mistake. That was the Chafetz Chaim's line. Huh? Yeah, I heard this story in elementary school. I grew up on this story. The Torah tells us that the tribes, they each had their unique signs, and we have a tradition what the flags of each tribe was. And the Torah also describes to us the whole setting of which tribe was to the north and the south and the east and the west. You guys can take out the stone Chumash, the art scroll Chumashim. They have a map in the back. They'll show it to you. They'll describe it better than I could describe it here in words. If you want to know the flags, so that's what I told you previous years. I took the time to explain each flag and heads started drooping. So I decided I don't do that anymore. You guys can see my notes online. Go to torahforme.org or 123torah.org and you'll see on the notes on Parshas Bamidbar, I have outlined the flag of each tribe. What was there? Each tribe had their color. Each tribe had their animal. Each tribe had their design that reflected their portion in the land of Israel, their strengths in this world, their spiritual strengths. And I have on tradition from Rav Pesin Zatzal that the tribes were not only divided in their flags and in the places they were situated, but each flag had their own design on their talis. You could look at a person and see the talis he was wearing. Based on the design, you could know what tribe he was from. The Torah then says, these are the descendants of Moshe and Aharon. And it recounts the descendants of Aharon. Why are they called Moshe's descendants? So we have a tradition that the reason is that the Torah was teaching us, if you educate someone else's son, it's as though you gave birth to that child. And this has halachic implications, because we have a mitzvah of pru urvu, bring children to the world. But that mitzvah has two steps to it. One is to procreate, have children. Two is to educate. A person that has children but does not educate them has not fulfilled pru urvu. If the children are not Torah observant, he has not fulfilled pru urvu. A person can have 500 children. He could be Haman. 500 children. Boys, girls. But if they're not Torah observant, he hasn't kept the mitzvah of pru urvu. So the mitzvah of pru urvu is two-step. One, bring a boy and a girl to the world. Have one boy and one girl. Two, that boy and girl have to be Torah observant. So if a person educates his friend's children, he's keeping half of the mitzvah. He's helping them be Torah observant. He's helping them lead moral lives. And if you think about it, the philosophical implications are tremendous. The Torah didn't just say procreate, bring people to the world, let them behave like monkeys. The Torah said, I want people who are going to be humans. I want people who are going to live up to a certain standard. That's the mitzvah of pru urvu. The parasha concludes with the covering of the different vessels of the Mishkan. And we have a specific tradition as to how they were covered. Each vessel had their covering. The Shulchan first had a royal blue covering. And then it had a royal red covering, and finally a leather covering. The menorah had royal blue, and on top of that a leather covering of tachash, multiple colors, an animal that whose leather was multiple colors. The golden mizbeach, again, had royal blue, on top of which was that colorful leather. And okay, we won't go into each one. One of the points that give over importance to our children, and with this we will wish everyone a good Shabbos, is the encasings we give things. When you cover the challahs, you're saying this isn't just bread. Yes, putting something under the challahs, putting something over the challahs is indicative of the man that had a covering above and below, but the way you treat something indicates something. You have a talis and tefillin, you get a nice talis bag, you're saying something to the kid. It's not just about, I have a talis, I have a tefillin, and I put them in a plastic bag. If I cherish something, I cover it. And this is something to think about, because these are subtle messages that we give ourselves and that we give our children. Where do we store things? And I'll just give you a practical tip that that also I use this concept with. And this isn't my idea. I don't remember who I learned it from. I come from a Yekish family. And among the Yekis, traditionally there were women who, I don't know if the rabbis approved it or not, but they would shake men's hands. And at the end of the day, when I have family gatherings, so my old great aunts and stuff, they all want to shake my hand. And I don't shake women's hands. So, of course, people can be very offended if they want to shake your hand and you don't want to shake their hand. So I stand and explain to them. I say to them, you know, we don't touch a Torah directly. Torah has a covering, and we only kiss it with a tzitzis. We touch to the covering, because things that are cherished, well, they have coverings and you don't touch them directly. So I was taught, this is the way I explain it to them, that a woman is something to be cherished, something to be treated with respect. Between her and her husband, that's where touch is appropriate. And anyone else has to treat her with such respect that he wouldn't touch her directly. Shabbat Shalom.
Right now.